Bonsoir, Dave.
Oh, buongiorno, Steele. How you doing, buddy?
Dave, I'm doing pretty mellow, I have to say.
Yeah, what have you not been sleeping? What's the deal, man?
I don't know. Just trying to figure all that stuff out with sleep and all that. But let's not talk about me. How about you? Your hair's looking enormous.
Oh yeah, I've had a lot of hair questions and thoughts recently. I think we're going to discuss it a little bit later on in the episode because I've got some important questions for you and for our wonderful guest, my top-rated neighbor of all time, Rosie.
Wow. Rosie, welcome back.
Hi. It's great to be back.
So what do you think?
I wanted to let you guys know how much I like this podcast because while we're recording, my Utah Jazz are in a fourth quarter of a close game and I'm missing an opportunity to relish in a Republican debate.
The
but
things you sacrifice.
Two of my favorite things right now.
So who are you a Ben Carson lady or are you more going for Trump? Which corner are you in?
Oh, yeah. I really like what both of them have to say in certain ways, not political ways, but it's really entertaining.
Yeah.
I think they might, do you think they're both just running ironically for comedy's sake? Because if so, like Trump is just nailing it. It's terrific.
I know. But then, you know, you've got this whole mystery going on with Carson on whether or not he really stabbed someone or if he just, it's trying to play off like you did for political gain. And I just really want to get to the bottom of that. I tune in every day for an update on the stabbing.
I have to say, I'm almost as interested to hear more of his take on the pyramids.
Oh, yeah.
Have you been following this?
Oh, yeah.
He's a pyramid truther.
Wait, what's the deal with the pyramids? Because I don't follow politics. What's he been saying?
They were not built, Dave, as the archaeologists think, as elaborate tombs for Egyptian kings. No. They were built by Joseph from the Bible as a place to store the grain for the 7 years of famine that were coming.
It seems like an excellent storage facility. So, yeah, that's legitimate. Is he also a 9/11 truther? Is he on that too?
Have not heard from him on that topic.
It's only a matter of time.
Hopefully it's something that comes up in the debate tonight. I think there's probably a lot of really interesting perspectives.
The one headline that I read recently is that Jeb Bush would, if he could go back in time and kill baby Hitler, he would do it. So he gets my vote.
Yeah. Talk about hard-hitting important issues of the day. I have to say, Dave, with that light behind you, I feel like this is something out of the Joseph Smith film. You got the 1800s hair and you got a blinding light over your head.
It's just so that you can understand everything I'm speaking is truth. I just want you to know that.
You're like walked off the set of There Will Be Blood.
Well, what are we talking about today, Steele? What's our topic?
We have so much to talk about. We are going to talk about times of our life that we spent in character. We have a very special section of small talk. We have off-the-chain literary characters, a great new segment, Everyday Questions with Rosie, which is going to blow some people's minds. And then, as always, we're going to end with Unchained Melodies and Book Wisdom. The theme this week, though, is characters. And we have one of the very best characters that we've ever met, ever had on the show. Rosie, can you tell us about a time that you pretended to be something that you weren't?
Right. Well, I thought about this question a bit, and I think one of the best times was when I first met my husband. And it wasn't at a costume party. You know, it wasn't Halloween or anything, but I was actually pretending to be a married woman, which is what I was doing in those days, freshman year in college. And I think I realized at one point I got this ring and it just kind of fit best on that finger. And I would wear it and I would get questions about it in classes, you know, and I had come from high school, which that even if you wore a ring there, you weren't going to get questions on whether or not you were married. But then all of a sudden I was at college and I was like, wow, I guess, it kind of is starting to mean something in my life if I do this. And then I had some I don't know, awkward dates, interactions, just pretty soon I thought, you know, this could actually be a really good costume, a character here that I could put on and just kind of nix those interactions I just wasn't really looking for at that time in my life.
So some awkward young men. So it was like awkward young man repellent?
Yeah, basically is what I was going for. So I just always wore a ring on that finger. So I think the first thing that my husband actually ever said to me was, is that a wedding ring?
And, wait, what was your answer?
Yeah, and the first thing I ever said back to him was a lie, which was, yes, it is. But I had known him. He was in one of my classes, and I could tell that he was actually a pretty cool guy and that maybe we could hang out. So I told him, you know, it's pretty shortly after it came out that I was joking.
Wait, so he got right to the point. The first thing he ever said to you was just, is that a wedding ring? He just wanted to know whether it was worth talking to you or not.
Isn't that funny? Well, the way he tells it is that he had been, you know, looking at it in class for a couple weeks, you know, and it's kind of like, is it? She just doesn't seem like a married woman. You know, obviously the rest of my character was failing. It was more of a costume, I guess. Huh. And he said that when he finally was like, I just kind of need to, you know, find out if it is for sure. And he said, he's like, and if she is, then, you know, I'll just flatter her. And if not, then maybe I'll get a date.
Wow.
So now I kind of have to worry about, you know, whether or not he still just flatters married women for the fun of it or not.
Seriously.
But that's dedication. He knew. He knew what he wanted, Rosie. The wedding ring didn't stop him. He wanted to be sure.
No. Yeah. And he got through. And I wasn't, like I said, I wasn't looking for that type of thing. And he got to me and I got married way too early.
But yeah. What, was it 16 that you got married at, Rosie?
16, yeah.
Sweet 16. Yeah, your dad had to sign a document saying that was okay, but he's a wonderful man. I
vouch for him.
Yeah, I got married way too young too, Rosie, but it didn't work out. It was the worst mistake I ever made.
Dang, it's probably because it wasn't built on a, you know, a lie like ours was. That first word.
It was built
on
different lies, I think. More dangerous ones, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, that's my role in the show. Just be a downer.
Yes.
I have a question, though. Follow up, Rosie, very quickly. You mentioned that this was like a helpful deterrent, but were there other situations in which wearing a wedding ring was not the deterrent that you hoped? That there was like someone just continued sort of...
Even with the wedding ring?
Yeah. Did it work, or was it ineffective against some superpowers?
Well, yeah, I guess we don't know how well it actually worked because, like you said, you know, it's kind of strange that my husband ended up asking me about it. You know, he didn't just assume.
Yeah.
Where I have to think that some of them just kind of saw it and were like, you know, off limits.
Yeah.
So I like to believe that there were a few weird guys out there that just never even tried.
Nice.
But the weirdest one made it through.
Yeah, that's what I was going to. How about you, Dave? A time you spent in character? Pretending you were something you weren't?
Still, other than my entire life and career as a nurse, one terrific time. I've been on some bad dates in my life still, if you believe that or not.
I'm not so sure about that.
I didn't always have this hair and this facial hair. It wasn't always working for me so well. So I asked a girl out, and I just asked her to go see a movie with me. And like thinking back on this now, I just should have called abort so many times. Just be like, yeah, never mind. But she wanted a roommate to come with us. And they ended up riding in the back seat together while I drove like a limo in the front seat.
Chauffeur.
And things like quickly deteriorated, but fortunately I just decided like, I'm just going to go for it. If this is going to happen, if this is this bad, I want this girl to remember this date the rest of her life. And so I said all sorts of stuff. I was just going, talking crazy talk, but I went off for like a good 15 minutes about how I had walked onto the BYU football team and I got a lot of downs at linebacker. I was middle linebacker on the BYU linebacker. Football team.
Naturally.
Now, Dave, because this is radio, I don't think everyone has a clear idea of your physical stature. Where would you put your height, weight at college?
I think you could just sum it up by saying 12-year-old boy, right?
Okay. So typical big college middle linebacker frame.
Yeah, 5'7", 120, like ready to rumble. There was never a second date. I never saw that girl again, but I like to believe that she still remembers that date with that small man that lied to her.
Man, if it happened nowadays, she'd have the smartphone out and she'd be Googling you. She'd figure it out real fast.
Kids, yeah, small men these days have a lot harder time of it than I did. I'll tell you what.
Man, I feel like, was this when we were living next door to each other, Dave?
Yeah, this was. Yeah, I probably told you about it, but you probably forgot at some point.
I was
point
probably
in
on
life.
The phone with my ex-wife.
Yeah, you were yelling about it to her about the college football rankings, so.
Yeah. Just get it straight. Coach's poll has more weight than Sagarin's computer rankings.
AP's voted on by the press, okay? The press.
Oh, man, I was trying to think of this for me, and pretending to be something that I wasn't, I feel like that was basically the entirety of college. That was like what we did. We just made up stories and lied about stuff.
All of our stories have come out of college times.
But I don't have a real good story, but I would say my greatest accomplishment up till now is pretending to be interested in Vin Diesel and action movies every time Dave mentions them on the podcast.
And still, this is our 40th show, so that's got to be, what, 39 mentions of Vin Diesel so far? Have we gone through a show without talking about him?
I would probably guess not. I think probably – actually, that'd be a good research project if someone had a lot of time and was very sad. Yeah, I don't know. We probably mention him just about every time, and you're always super enthusiastic. And I think this podcast basically began because you had a desire to talk more about Vin Diesel and your wife was sick of it. So it's sort of something that I felt like I had to do in a sort of therapeutic function just to keep the podcast going. But in my heart of hearts, I have no real interest in Vin Diesel, although I'm going to watch 3 of his films in the next year.
And then you'll finally understand. Wait, Rosie, have you ever seen a Vin Diesel movie? Has that ever happened for you?
I really don't think I have.
Oh, man.
I'm sorry. Nice.
No, don't be sorry, Rosie. I haven't either.
I can picture who he is.
Yeah.
Does that count for anything?
Yeah, counts for a lot.
But, Rosie, this is why I bring you on the podcast, so that Steele can feel more comfortable at least a few podcasts a year, you know?
Right.
Someone who reads books and doesn't watch Vin Diesel movie. I'm like,
you're not
so
alone.
Glad that Dave has at least one other friend like that.
We're a minority, but a strong minority.
So that's our opening kind of a segment about being in character. So basically the premise is pretending to be something that you aren't can either be disastrous or the best thing ever in your romantic life. Is that fair summation?
Yes, I think most good romance is based on pretending to be something you're not. So until they figure out otherwise.
Great. Hey, well, small talk. This is one of our best segments, and it's where we just share with you an anecdote, a story, something of interest that you need to know about, to think about, to talk about in order to make your next awkward conversation that much better. And because this is the characters edition of the podcast, we have a couple of really intense characters to tell you about. Dave, I think you need to lead us off because this one, I don't know if I can handle it.
I think character defines this guy. So, Steele, if I told you that there was a man that hasn't showered for over 12 years, what would you suspect that he looks like?
I'm pretty sure that this guy was my mission companion. I trained him and... he had an antibacterial toothpaste he had to use because he had literally gone 7 years once without brushing his teeth.
So this guy, I read about him on Yahoo by the name of David, I'm just going to say David Whitlock. It's close enough.
Okay.
But this guy is...
Yahoo doesn't bother including last names with their news articles these days anyway.
No, it is David Whitlock. Well done. Well done by me. So he developed a small bacterial spray that you spray on your body every day. This bacteria eats the bacteria on your body that causes odor. Mm. And so you don't have to shower. So he hasn't showered for over 12 years because he just has a bottle of bacterial spray.
So, Dave, you posted a photo of this guy. And I have to say, I was 100% convinced that this was Alan and John's dad. He looked just like Papa Stouffer. I'm not going to say his first name in case he listens.
And he looks exactly like I just read the headline to the article, and then I opened it up. And I was like, wow.
That's
like this guy. This is exactly what I was imagining in my mind. David Whitlock is this man, a little bit overweight, large glasses, bald, except on the sides he has curly gray hair. And it looks like all he wears is jackets with no shirts underneath.
He's also, this is obviously obvious, but he's Caucasian.
Yes, I didn't even think I had to mention that.
Specify.
So, Rosie, are you on board? Do you want the bacterial spray?
Well, I'm wondering if, in reference to this being, you know, used in small talk, is your suggestion that maybe next time, you know, like I'm on the subway next to someone that smells a little unpleasant, like maybe I should just move over and say, hey, you know, have you heard about this bacterial spray?
And I think it would open a lot of doors and friendships for you, yes.
And it's got a snazzy acronym. They call it AOB. Hey, buddy, you want some AOB?
Yeah.
So they call it.
It's so good, but he is definitely a character, and I salute him.
So where did this begin for him? Was it that he has some kind of pathological fear of water? Is it like fear of showering, fear of bathing? Or is it just like, hey, this is inefficient. I'm going to spend several years developing a product to remove the few seconds I have to take cleaning myself.
I think he wasn't into it, you know? He wasn't showering very much. He figured, you know, the animals don't bathe very often and they don't stink. How do they take care of this?
Wait, and hold on. Animals don't stink?
No, they smell great, according to David Whitlock.
Okay. Nice.
And if animals can go without showering, then certainly mankind can. We just needed a spray. So, yeah, I'm starting today. I will not shower for the next 12 years. I'm just using the AOB as well. Which stands that's short for ammonia oxidizing bacteria. And if there's one thing I know about ammonia is it smells great.
And, you know, fighting fire with fire. You kill this bad smelling bacteria with an odor neutral bacteria. That's the way I always do things.
Of course.
Well, can I tell you, Rosie, about my character this week?
Yeah, please do.
Have you ever heard of a little woman named Serpentfoot?
Double first name, double last name. Not sure what that is.
This is a reduplication is what it's called. Their duplicative names are my favorite names in the world. We're going to have a whole episode probably dedicated to names, and I'll have a big segment about them. But for now, I just want to give you a little taste of this 82-year-old rural Georgia woman whose name is Serpentfoot. She had a story published about her because she was tired of the name Serpentfoot. And she wanted to change it. And a judge blocked her from changing her name, even though her new name, she claimed, was an expression of her unique religious philosophy. She is the founder of a church. She has a very important theological message for the whole world. And the proposed new name, if you have a few minutes, I'll share it with you. It is No Foot, All Foot, 69, Mouth, Tail, Solids, Liquids, Gases, Animal, Vegetable, Mineral, all predators and prey that consume and move with feet, fins, wings, wheels, canes, roots, limbs, vines, landslides, dust, wind, water, fire, ice, gravity, vacuums, black holes, going over, under, around, and through our greater self, our habitat, the cosmos of which we are but part, and where all life feeds upon other life from the smallest atoms or bacteria to the great black holes and dog-eat-dog and, quote, last suppers, unquote, where we are what we eat or consume, and each lives on in the other, infinity Serpentfoot.
So she's not forsaking Serpentfoot altogether.
No, I mean, she's still, she doesn't want to give up the family name. She's just changing the first name.
I think that she would be good friends with Dr. Bronner. You know, the Dr. Bronner soaps?
Yes, as well as the guy who
makes the...
He has a
message like that on his soaps. I mean, I think they'd have a lot to talk about.
And whoever makes that Egyptian magic cream, have you guys ever seen that?
No, but I'd like to.
They sell it at Costco. Oh. It's like a salve, and it's some guy who claims to be the Pharaoh Otep Ra or something. Any case, I love this Serpentfoot woman. The more I read about her, the better she sounds.
So wait, so what's this judge's problem? Is he Judge Buzzkill? What's his deal?
Apparently he doesn't believe in the freedom of religion. Here was his argument. The Floyd County judge said, he basically said, Serpentfoot, you want to change your name? Can you just recite the name for her? And she got stuck like six words in and couldn't remember the rest of the name. And he says, listen, if you can't even remember the own name that you want to have, I think this name is going to be a barrier and obstacle for other people who might want to use your name. Apparently, she has been the party to like dozens of lawsuits over the last several years where people have sued her. And what? So he felt that it's so long that anybody who wants to sue or prosecute her will become too confused to file accurate court documents. He thought it was a ploy by her to avoid being served with papers and be named as a defendant in lawsuits. So he said, no, you can't do it.
Goodness.
She says, you know, it seems like a long name, but it's a short, quick message that covers everything.
Do you think she could change her name to that on Facebook? Do you think there's a character limit?
That's a great question. No, we should write Zuckerberg and find out whether he's a serpent foot religion discriminator.
Yeah, once we get him on the podcast, I think that's question number one. So,
but although people like to mock and ridicule Serpentfoot, I will say she has done something tremendous. She moved to a ghost town in Chattooga County. The area was called Tulip, and she said, nope, Tulip's not what this area is called anymore. I am changing it to poetry. She changed the area to poetry. And she wanted to try to create a writer's village and spread a new wave of poetry throughout the country. She formed a Poets of Georgia Incorporated group. More than 300 people joined the group. She launched a magazine or a publication called Poets Monthly. And in January 1974, she published her own poetry next to then-governor and future president Jimmy Carter.
That's beautiful. Do you currently subscribe to Poetry Monthly? Is that correct?
Basically, yeah. I mean, I would say I'm one of its biggest financial backers. I am an honorary resident, like Jimmy Carter, of Poetry Georgia.
So the small talk sum up is Serpentfoot, fantastic name, but there is a way to top that.
Hold on.
Oh.
I haven't mentioned the greatest point of Serpentfoot. In 1995, she went to the city commission. She was protesting their decision. They decided they were going to pray at the beginning of all their meetings. She was going to protest that choice. And they started praying anyway, so she stripped off all of her clothes and then was arrested. She thought, you know what? You're going to pray. I'm going to take my clothes off. And she said, I did a little body language. The body is a temple. Boom. Drop the mic, Serpentfoot.
Serpentfoot out.
She said, you're violating my religion for arresting me for taking my clothes off.
Does she have a memoir?
She does. She has several books that she's published, self-published. I don't know if it's as much memoir as religious ramblings, but I believe that they are awesome books. You can, I don't even want to send you to this site.
yeah, but, I don't want to go there.
No. But Serpentfoot, great fodder for your next small talk. You still think you can top it, Dave?
That name, no. But I let's see what Rosie has to top it for small talk. What do you got, Rosie?
Okay.
Oh, well, I don't have characters as good as that. But I was thinking about some of the people who play some of our beloved characters in films or our characters themselves. And I was reading an article about the New York Marathon that happened recently. And since moving to Boston, I've been a little more into marathons, attended the Boston Marathon, not to be confused with ran the Boston Marathon this year. But I found a list of celebrity marathon times.
Oh.
Like the, you know, how fast they completed it. And I thought I might give you guys just a little quiz on who was faster. on a couple of these celebrities.
I'm ready.
I'm going to say the answer is always Rosie O'Donnell.
I don't have her number. Okay. I don't have her time here.
She's an Olympic qualifier, pretty sure.
Probably the fastest. All right, let's start with P. Diddy or George Bush. Who ran it faster?
Ooh. Diddy.
George
Diddy.
Bush. George Bush.
George Bush.
No, Diddy? Come
on. Yeah, it looks like he beat him by a half hour.
Come on, Dave.
Wait, what was Bush's time?
3 hours, 44 minutes.
Was it cocaine aided or no?
don't have that data.
Asterisk.
It was in 1993. I maybe should have
probably cocaine aided. Yes.
Okay, another one. Will Ferrell or Alicia Keys? Who ran it faster?
Ooh, Will Ferrell.
I like Will. I support Will Ferrell as well.
He did. He did. Yes. He did run it faster by over an hour.
Oh yeah.
Alicia Keys was actually the slowest on my list. Yeah, she did it in 5 hours and 50 minutes.
Oh, wow, was she just walking? Come on, Alicia.
Yeah. Okay, Ed Norton or Ethan Hawke? This is a tough one.
Yeah, this one's real hard.
Ed Norton, way tougher. Way tougher, dude.
I'm going to go with Ethan Hawke.
It was Ed Norton.
Boom.
Okay, the athletes. Lance Armstrong or Apollo Anton Ohno? And again, I don't have any information on drug supplements that were used by either competitor.
I hope it's really Apollo Anton Ohno. I like that guy.
I was hoping you were going to say Apollo Creed because that's who I'd vote for.
I'll go
Lance Armstrong. I think Lance has got it. You know he blood doped for it.
Yeah, but look at Apollo Anton Ohno. He has awesome chin strap thing, whatever it's called.
Yeah, it was Lance.
Boom.
2 hours and 46 minutes.
The guy's driven.
Yeah.
He basically could have run two of them in the time Alicia Keys ran her marathon.
that's accurate. Okay, and last one, Pamela Anderson or Sarah Palin?
I'm going Palin.
Anderson.
Palin.
Boom.
Sarah Palin was the fastest woman on my list. Under 4 hours. Four hours. Any witnesses?
Or was this one of those Ben Carson tall tales, stab a friend kind of things?
Yeah. You can't be certain.
I heard she stabbed someone at the finish line, actually, so... Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. That's actually that would be a fantastic party quiz game.
Yeah. I know. It's full of surprises.
Yeah, you bring that to a party, like people are surrounding you and really they think you're cool.
That's what I'm about.
Hold on, everybody. Put down your drinks. I have a list of celebrity marathon completion times. Line up for the quiz.
Celebrity speedsters.
Yeah. So where did you find those, Rosie?
Well, Stephen Colbert had Ethan Hawke on last night. And Ethan Hawke, he just ran it a couple weeks ago, the New York Marathon. He was giving him he was complimenting him on beating Alicia Keys because she also ran it this year. And so then I looked it up, wanted more data.
I love
important
it.
Topic. Dave, have you ran a marathon?
No, I did. I ran a half marathon once. And I got the runs wicked bad. I stopped to poop literally 6 times or more along the way. Anytime there was an opportunity to poop, I did it. I still did it pretty quickly, but.
How about you, Rosie? Have you run a marathon?
No, I haven't. I would like to just to know where I fall on this list. You know, if I'm more Alicia Keys or more George Bush.
Train, do some cocaine, and I think you could give Bush a run for his money.
A run for his money. Oh, boy. Well, that was great. That's small talk. We've got Serpentfoot, Serpentfoot. We've got the Stouffer's dad who never showers, and we've got celebrity marathon times. All right, so now we've got a new segment, Dave. This is called Off the Chain Literary Characters, and this is where we're just going to discuss either one of our favorites or most impressive, most memorable literary characters. Someone we learned about in a book that wasn't real, but became real to us in some unforgettable way.
I'm pretty excited about this one. This character is what led me to want to even do this segment. Now, I've talked to Rosie. I know she's read Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. Have you ever read that one, Steele?
I never did, Dave.
Okay.
I was scared.
Well, after I describe this to you, you're either going to read it or be too afraid to do so.
Both, probably. So, probably a little of both.
Just the character that I still think about, and I'm rereading the book again now, is Judge Holden. He's the judge. This character, he's nearly 7 feet tall. He usually wears black, and he has not a speck of hair on his body. And he's a judge of some sort. No one knows kind of where he got that title from or why he's known as the judge, but he's the judge. And he's introduced in one of the first scenes in the book, which I'm going to describe to you a little bit because I love it. So the main character of the book is, it's raining outside. He goes into a tent where there's this large religious revival meeting going on, and everybody's listening to this preacher. This preacher is doing a great job. Everybody is really enjoying it. And then in from the rain, the judge steps into the tent near the front of the tent, and everyone just kind of stops and looks at this man because of just the power of his character and the height of him and just the sheer just strangeness of him. And he stops the reverend from preaching and begins to level a series of terrible accusations against the preacher that he was caught defiling an 11-year-old girl in Arkansas, that he was caught in another state doing the same thing to a goat. And people just get enraged. They tear down the tent. They run this preacher out of town. It's potential that they actually lynch this preacher. It's unknown. It goes to another scene. And then the next scene, the judge is in the bar. The main character's there. And someone asks the judge, like, how did you know all that stuff? How did you get the goods on that guy? And the judge just says, I'd never seen that man before in my life.
Dun, dun, dun.
And it just every scene with him is just very clever, very funny. And through the book, I don't know, Rosie, is he the personification of Satan or evil? I'm sure someone.
It's a debate between, you know, if he's just encapsulates all that's the devilish side of humanity, or, you know, is he the devil himself? I think all readers of the book are trying to figure that question out.
And later on in the book, they're being chased by Native Americans across northern Mexico. This large group of people have just been hunting Native Americans to scalp them. Just terrible deeds. But they've run out of gunpowder. So these Native Americans are going to slaughter them. And just the judge takes them on a strange series of things where he gathers different materials. Eventually, they're up on a hillside kind of trying to hold off. And the judge is urinating into this powder that he's formed. And once it dries, whatever is in the urine makes it so the judge has gathered all the materials for gunpowder. So they're able to, of course, slaughter all the Native Americans that were chasing them.
That's great. Great news.
Yeah, they got a few dozen more scalps there still. It was
good
great.
Job, judge.
I think an important aspect of the judge is that he's very sharp and scholarly, definitely uses his intelligence to manipulate. A thing that's kind of odd about him is that he meticulously sketches and collects specimens of unfamiliar species, you know, wherever he goes. He's very in tune with the earth. And I pulled out one of the lines where someone asks him, you know, why are you always sketching and collecting things? And he says, whatever in creation exists without my knowledge exists without my consent. Thinks he has hand on everything. Everything is in his control. Or if it's not in his control, then to him, it's like it's not even real.
And so there's just this, yeah, just this darkness to the character that's so real. And the character's so well drawn out. Of all of Cormac McCarthy's novels that I've read, this is the character that just haunts me still. I'm not going to tell you the final scene of the book, but the final scene is just kind of terrifying. I still kind of picture it in my mind of the judge doing something terrible. That judge.
Anytime that it can be said of you that you make your living as a professional scalp hunter, there's probably not a lot of redeeming character traits that people are going to be praising you for after reading the book about you.
No, the first time I read the book, I told my wife, like, that book was maybe the best book I've ever read, and I'm never reading that book again. And then a couple of years later, I read it again, and now I'm reading it again, except this time we're reading it together.
Just before bed?
I had a very similar reaction to the book. And the last thing I would add about the judge is it's kind of, you have a similar reaction to the judge because, like, he's basically described, like you said, he's like a giant newborn baby or something, like really disturbing, right? Like gigantic, but he's described as having small hands and feet, but hairless, and is evil and violent. But at the same time, he's like kind of his prowess over words and creation and his intelligence. Like there's something kind of attractive about him, and you're scared that you like him, right? When you read the book, you're like, I hope that this scene has the judge in it. And then you're like, what's wrong with me? This is terrible.
Wow.
And so that Cormac McCarthy has kind of been able to capture you in that way without any, you know, like physical attraction. Cause you know, he sounds horrific, but you're just like, I just want to hear this man speak.
I'm glad you're here, Rosie. Cause I love this character, and I don't feel like I could bring him across as well. So I think the things that you added just really help people understand that character. And it's just so good.
It is.
Okay, so he's super verbal. My character is probably the opposite. Everyone thinks he's the worst. He never speaks, but deep down, he's really a good one. This is my character is Boo Radley from To Kill a Mockingbird.
That's just a terrific book. That's one of the books in high school that you have to read because it's actually really good.
Yeah. I know everybody's super upset about Go Set a Watchman, how it ruins Atticus Finch's legacy a little bit.
Right.
As long as it doesn't mess with Boo Radley, I think whatever he wants to do is fine. But if it turns out that Boo Radley really was like a killer and like all these bad things, that's a book that deserves to be burned.
Right.
Why Boo Radley? Why do you love him so much?
I'm not sure exactly. I think probably just the right character at the right time in my life, where I haven't read the book since I was a teenager, but I remember I was an eccentric teenager, as you might imagine, Dave, in lots of ways. But one of the ways that I was eccentric, I remember this kind of really romantic notion about the library, in that I was like, here's what I'm going to do. I am just going to grow up and be like a 30-something-year-old Thoreau, where I am homeless, voluntarily homeless, and I just live in a library, basically. And I just come in the library and I write these like incredible great poems in the margins of really awesome books. So only really, really cool books, but that are kind of not well known. So if someone comes to my library and checks out the book, they'll be able to read these like incredible life-changing poems that aren't published anywhere, but they're just written in the margins of like carefully selected library books. And that was like my life ideal. So there's something about, I think, that hidden goodness or the hidden greatness and the kind of hermeticism, I guess, about there's something kind of hermit-like about Boo, where he clearly wants to have the friendship with the children, where he's putting gifts and exchanging them in the little hole of the tree. But there's something preventing him from, whether it's introversion or whether it's his terrifying dad or whether it's something from his past or whatever. We don't exactly know what inhibits Boo. But he's inhibited, and yet he desires to make that kind of like positive social connection. And I think that was probably a real attractive thing to me as a kind of impressionable teen.
And the flawed character that has a hard time interacting with people, but that has just the heart of gold, that draws you into just about anybody. It's wonderful to meet someone and then to get past whatever issues they have and just to meet and understand just the goodness that they have in them.
Yeah. And I feel like the whole book, like obviously we empathize with Atticus and how great he is in fighting against racism and fighting for justice. And we certainly identify with Scout and Jem. And then obviously the stories about the injustice done to Tom, you know, and this false claim of rape. And so we identify there and we think, oh, wow, we want things to come out right in the end. But there's something also I think that was really powerful to me about the sense of misjudgment. Like, everybody judges Boo Radley wrongly. Just like they misjudge the town drunk, and you understand the story underneath it. But there's a sense that, like, society has ganged up to say this person is evil or bad or wrong, but actually they're looking out for someone. They're actually deeply good. And that, I think, is really powerful, too, because I think at that age I felt a lot of alienation or kind of, like, anger, I guess, towards authority figures and towards society. And the sense that, like, society is wrong about this or about this person. And this person really is deeply good, even though everyone's judging them or condemning them. Like the idea of the unjustly convicted prisoner who, at heart, only wants to do good. The Les Mis kind of story.
And I think that that can be applied, that idea can be applied really well modernly. Kind of the crowd mentality. There's a lot of that on the internet and the modern U.S. culture. Just the crowd is who's right. And that's scary.
Definitely. I haven't read the novel for such a long time. Rosie, do you remember anything about Boo's family? I'm trying to recall. I think he had a bad dad or an abusive dad or a mean dad, but I don't recall specifically.
No, it's been a long time since I've read it. The only thing I'm actually remembering about Boo, other than his important part at the end, is that Robert Duvall played him in the movie.
Yeah, right? Obviously that's why I love him. Robert Duvall is
my
favorite actor.
That's really why I love him too.
So now we really understand. It's not literary character. It all goes back to Duvall with you, Steelman.
Yep, he's my Vin Diesel.
I love him too.
I've seen every movie he's been in, probably close to.
Was it one of his first?
I believe that was his first film.
His very
role.
First?
I think he was in some TV shows before that. I'll have to look it up.
So good. Well, Rosie, what do you got? What have you brought to the table for us?
Wow. Well, my character is a little complicated. What did you say about Boo? That he's kind of on the fringes of society, but lovable. My character is on the fringes of society, but hated. And not just by the people in the book, but by most people who read the book. So it's Meursault. The book is The Stranger by Albert Camus. Mm. It's written in French, translated to English. I read it when I was 17, and I literally was the only person in my class who remotely liked it. And I'm pretty certain that my teacher assigned it because he was just excited to see how a bunch of Mormon teenagers would squirm over this book. And I just denied him a portion of his pleasure because I loved the book. And it's all about Meursault and told from his perspective. Since it's a little lesser known, I'll give a little summary that Meursault lives in the French Algiers. He's mm-hmm. a French man, but the population of the French Algiers has many Arabs. And it starts with him attending his mother's funeral, in which he doesn't cry or show any emotion over, despite having a nice relationship with her. And then it evolves halfway through into a scene in which he shoots an Arab man on the beach, kind of out of nowhere. And after the murder, he goes to jail, is tried, and sentenced to execution. And you may think that that should have warranted like a little bit of a spoiler alert, but this book is not about plot at all. Uh-huh. And it's very much about the larger universe and Meursault's skewed perception of reality. And a significant detail is that in the trial scene, when he's being sentenced, it turns out that the jury is convicting him more because of their outrage over his lack of emotion towards his own mother's death than because of the murder. Hmm. Because this is a very racist French Arab society. And if he had just made any claim of self-defense, no one would pity that, you know, the death of an Arab in this society. But they, you know, opposing side pulls out that he didn't cry at his mother's funeral, and everyone is just so disturbed. And they ask him all these questions like, why, you know, why wouldn't you cry about your mom? Why don't you care about your mom? And the answer to Meursault, really his answer to everything, is it doesn't really matter. Well, so the author described Meursault in saying, in our society, any man who does not weep at his mother's funeral runs the risk of being sentenced to death. I only mean that the hero of my book is condemned not because he did not play the game. Hmm. So Meursault, I guess you would say he walks to the beat of his own drum, if you translate drum to mean universe. he has his very own worldview and has constructed his own idea of social norms and even his own moral framework. And it's something that's very new and very honest.
So how is it different, from French society? What sets him apart?
Well, he rejects the notion that we can really inflict any change in our place in the universe. That rather than fighting our fate and affairs in life, we can recognize that the universe is indifferent to our affairs and that there really aren't rational order and meaning. So there's one scene in the book where the girl, his girlfriend, says, should we get married? And he's like, if you want, and she's like, would you like to get married? And he's like, it doesn't really matter. Sure, if you'd like to. And then she says, would you say the same thing to someone else that, you liked as much as me? He says, yeah, I guess I would. I don't know.
I remember.
He's a very interesting character. He's totally anti-conformist, the ultimate anti-conformist. And though I don't love this character because I share his worldview, but I think I had this realization when I read it that, we can be more creative in how we think about the universe and the world. And it kind of got me thinking about the nature of the universe for the first time.
Wow. And you were high school, probably around the same age I was when I read, I guess, Boo Radley, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a short book, so I've revisited it since then, but...
I recall this book very vaguely from about the same period in my life, Rosie. And the feeling that I remember from was both this strong sense of the absurd, like the absurdity of effort or the absurdity of the elaborate constructions we make of society and going through this vast pretense of feeling and sharing emotion. And also I feel like there was something about just the character's indifference, essential indifference.
Right.
That you're kind of articulating and expressing. And I remember later reading, and Julia talked about this when she was a guest on the show, David, Bartleby the Scrivener, just saying he'd prefer not to, perpetual refusal to care or to do something.
Exactly.
And Meursault's is different because he does. He kills a guy.
Right.
But his is the refusal to emote or to feel strongly about a thing.
Right,
or to rage against the futility.
Yeah, so why would you?
Yeah, right? It's like life is futile, but I'm not going to become upset that it's futile and try to make it less futile. I'm just going to say, yes, it's futile.
That's what is beautiful about it. He's a very, he's a happy, hopeful person in a way that it's just like, I know where I'm at in the universe. I know it doesn't care about me. I know that things aren't rational and don't make sense. Like, I can accept that. I'm okay. There's no surprises here. He says this line, towards the very end is, I laid my heart open to the benign indifference of the universe, to feel it so like myself, indeed so brotherly, made me realize that I'd been happy and that I was happy still.
And this is right before he's about to be publicly executed.
Right.
Yeah.
Of which he's very, very happy about because it's a sign that society... he doesn't belong to their same universe, really. They're like, they're putting him to death. Like, we want you out of here. And he's like, great, because I don't want to be in your universe. It doesn't, it's not mine.
I think Dave's really into this guy.
The modern version of this guy seems like the guy that just got fired from his telemarketing job. I just don't care.
Well, others have, but the other modern guy, which I don't quite believe, but some people have said that he's a sociopath. Like, that's what Camus is getting at here, that, this is someone that's devoid of anything innately, remotely human about him and feelings towards other humans. I don't think that's accurate, but some people, in their confusion, my classmates who were just like, I hate this guy. I don't understand him. Why would he say that? They're trying to search.
Didn't he love his mother? They're recreating the jury.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what happened in my class.
Well, Rosie, you've proven your wisdom. You've proven your deep understanding of life. And so now it is time for a very special segment, Everyday Questions with Rosie.
It's Everyday Questions. These are kind of things that I need answers to right now. Like, I need your help too.
All right. Well, Rosie, throw two of them out there. I'm sure Dave's got some good answers. We'll try to do what we can, and then we'll see if our collective wisdom can't crack the nut on a couple of these.
Yeah. Collective wisdom. I like that. Well... let's throw out this one. How many dinners that involve lentils are too many in 1 week?
Whoa.
That would be, the answer is one. What? Anything more than zero. I can't handle lentils.
Dave, there's green lentils. There's red lentils. There's yellow lentils. You can make dal. I mean, right. We have lentils. If it was up to me, we'd have lentils 3 or 4 times a week. And
that's what we're doing here currently. So that's what I'm trying to figure out.
I think it's so great. I mean, the only thing you have to worry about is gas output, really. How long you've soaked them.
Right. That's true.
When I worked at Anasazi, I was out in the desert. I ate lentils every day, every single day, like lunch, breakfast, dinner. It was the only thing that I ate. So I can't eat them anymore. So the real answer is probably somewhere in between what I'm saying and what Steele's saying. I think 2 a week is probably your max.
So Dave has transcended lentils through Anasazi is basically what he's saying. He's an elite species now. The lentil-free man.
My bowel movements have still not recovered.
All right. Well, maybe I'll dial it back a couple nights.
All right. Well, I have an everyday question that's inspired by this question in a totally unrelated way. So here's the problem. My sister's getting married later this month, and I'm going to have to wear a shirt that tucks in, basically. And along with that shirt that tucks in, it's probably nice if I wear some dress shoes. And I do not own any black dress shoes. I haven't owned any for a couple of years now. But every once in a while, I get invited to a wedding for which dress shoes would be nice. My wife keeps telling me that it's a good idea. Go ahead and buy some black dress shoes, honey. Just get some shoes. But I haven't. And I've kind of been resisting it because, I don't know, they're expensive. And I just haven't found the right pair. What do I do?
My question is, do you have nice brown shoes?
I have brown boots, like Chukka desert boots. So I've worn those with like a blue suit, but they're not dressy. If I wore it with a tie, people would look a little strange at me, and they do, but whatever.
Brown is classier than black. Just wear them. You're good. That's
I don't need dress shoes.
Brown dress shoes. What about some secondhand dress shoes?
Sure.
Like don't put a lot of money into these dress shoes you're only going to wear a couple times a year and don't really want.
Nice.
You could find shoes that you know really speak to you that may be a little bit different from your normal black dress shoe. For instance, Steele, I'll show you the shoe I'm wearing right now.
Oh.
That. I wear that as a dress shoe.
You got to lift it a little higher for me.
That's what I wear as a dress shoe to church, work, whatever.
Nice. Looks you like could invest home sewn out of a pair of Levi's.
You could invest in a bolo tie because that might go better with your boots and it's still dressy.
Rosie, that cuts deep. That's the strongest argument I've heard for getting black dress shoes. If I ever stoop to a bolo tie, basically don't speak. I mean, just that's unspeakable. If I wore a banded collar, you should just put me out of my misery. And if I wore a bolo tie, I'm close second.
Well, if you're wearing those brown boots around, I mean, I haven't seen them, but if they are like what I'm picturing, like people might be just wondering, where's this bolo tie?
Oh,
if you're that against them, you don't want to be given off that vibe.
You're probably right, Rosie. You're talking sense to me. Okay, Dave, you got an everyday question for us?
I do. You were discussing my hairstyle earlier during the podcast, Steele. So this is my question I have for you. How much does the hairstyle of your healthcare provider matter to you? And should I do something with my hair?
Oh, great question. I would say, so I had the best DMV experience I ever had was from this guy who had a curly mullet. And I can only assume that the best medical care I would ever receive would be from someone with a similar haircut. I haven't had it yet. Most of my healthcare providers have been pretty conventional in the hair department. Nothing noticeable, nothing I remember. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I feel like I'm kind of inexperienced in this field.
Rosie?
Yeah, I don't really go to healthcare providers.
Ah, she's off the grid because she eats a lot of lentils.
I'm sorry. Yeah, the lentils keep me healthy.
Come on, this is everyday question. So
a bowl of lentil a day keeps the doctor away. That's what they say.
So you walk in, and the healthcare provider, you've never met him before. He looks like me. Are you comfortable with what's about to happen, especially if it involves a rectal exam? Steele.
Okay.
So what I would say, if you walk in and you're my healthcare provider, I'm going to look for like 3 seconds, just deliberately at the little hand soap on the wall until you actually apply some. And then I want to make sure you get it up to the elbow, not because of the rectal exam, because I hope it's not going that deep, but just because I'm like, this guy, I'm thinking you're a little James Whitlocky. That's all I'm saying.
I'm actually really good with my hand hygiene. But follow-up question, at what point can I finally stop expecting to get large zits on my face?
So I think this is – I mean, is it cystic acne, Dave, or is it hormonal, or is it just you don't take care of your face? The soap and water?
I'm washing daily, man.
Could be the problem.
I'm doing the best I can.
Once every 12 years works for some people.
Really, this is something I should be posing to David Whitlock. But when your healthcare provider walks in, floppy hair and a large zit on his face, like, I don't know what to do. I've already lost their trust. Hmm.
That's why you move to a small town where they don't have a lot of other options. And they're just like, stuck with me.
Done.
Okay.
Already done.
I don't know. I mean, there's in my household, there are people who have dealt with adult acne for years, and I know it's a frustration, but it's people, you can be loved through it.
Thank you, Steelman. Thank you. All right, Rosie, this is your segment. Do you have one more question that you
I
feel
do
like?
Because this one's relevant for tomorrow, so I need answers. It's Veterans Day. Have the day off work. Been really looking forward to it. My plan was to go hiking, and I'm looking at the forecast today, and, you know, it actually had this icon I wasn't quite familiar with. I was like, is that snow? Is that rain? And I clicked on it, and it said freezing rain. Like, I really want to hike.
Yeah.
Do I want to hike through the freezing rain or no? Do you guys have experience with freezing rain?
Well, I live in Wisconsin, so freezing rain is like midsummer weather here. Like, freezing rain, yeah, let's put on some shorts and go out to the beach. I would say, here's my first question, though. I don't have as much experience with the freezing rain, but my experience with weather is this. Was there freezing rain today?
I don't know. So I'm driving up to New Hampshire to be in the White Mountains, but I know that they're known for being pretty exposed and brutal. It's nice here in Boston.
So my rule of thumb is I always – just expect that the weather tomorrow will be whatever it was today. So what I do is if it's raining today, then I'll bring my umbrella tomorrow. And if it was sunny today, then I'm like, why would I need an umbrella tomorrow? It's often the recipe for disaster, but that's just how I'm wired. So
right.
I would say if it was freezing rain today, then you'd be like, yeah, it's going to be freezing rain tomorrow. But if it wasn't, then I would just bank on it not being freezing rain tomorrow. That's
gotcha.
My everyday advice. Dave?
So, Rosie, what I'd say is it's going to be terrible weather. Rest assured, it's the mountains in the Northeast. I've definitely been on top of a few mountains there with freezing rain, and it's brutal. But it's also really invigorating and refreshing. So if you're
like
ready
that.
To be invigorated, I say go for it. But I think you have to plan on there being freezing rain and it's going to hit your body and it's going to feel terrible, but also give you a chance for rebirth.
Thank you. That's what I need because I really want to go.
Key point, waterproof footwear. You want to keep your socks dry.
Right.
You can survive anything else on a hike, but if you get freezing rain, wet socks, then it will be less than invigorating. It'd be
right.
more immiserating.
I'll bring the Gore-Tex boots.
Okay. You win. Man, we just solved some everyday questions with Rosie. This can be a regular segment.
Yeah, we just need to keep bringing Rosie back for everyday questions with Rosie.
Anytime.
All right. I've been letting this run a little bit long, so we're going to punch through Unchained Melodies. These are some songs that are based on literary characters. And Rosie, you shared with us a great piece of literature that I believe inspired a song.
Right. With the background I gave, this song will now not sound, hopefully, quite so disturbing. There's no attempt to promote any violence toward Arabs on the show or at any time. But in honor of Marceau and his existential crisis, The Cure wrote a song called Killing an Arab.
Mm-hmm.
So subtle. I would never have guessed that was based on The Stranger or the scene where he kills an Arab on a beach.
No, I enjoyed it. My wife, who you know, loves The Cure, so I'm certain she would enjoy hearing killing an Arab.
Right. It said that in their first compilation of singles, it was packaged in the U.S. It was packaged with a sticker advising against racial usage of the song.
Oh, because we know America's very careful about gun violence.
And about racial discrimination against Arabs as well.
Oh, man.
All right, Dave.
Oh, my goodness. So if you want to know the greatest character in literary history, you don't have to look any further than the Hobbit, Bilbo Baggins. And if you want to know the biggest nerds in hard rock history, it's actually Led Zeppelin. Like 50% of their songs are based on The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings. But this one is terrific. This one is Over the Hills and Far Away. Here. Come on, Robert.
This is like the Jethro Tull song when he was peeing and whatever.
Hey, lady, you got the love on me. Baby, more than enough. Oh, darling, 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 walk wild with me. Oh, you got so much. So much, so much.
It was worth that 2 minute lead in.
They're just teasing you, Jimmy and Robert, making you wait. Oh, but when it comes in, so good.
All right. I've got another song with a long lead in, Dave, but it's a great one. It's about another cult classic children's lit-ish story. This comes from a C.S. Lewis story, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, I think. And it is a song called Prince Caspian by the jam band Phish. This is the 8 minute long live version. Whoops.
8 minute intro?
Probably. I know it's hard to believe, but there's another 6 minutes, and I don't believe they introduce any new lyrics into the song.
Oh, no. I mean, I really like it.
I just added it to my Spotify library still. So good.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah, that's a great, great song by a great American treasure. Okay, round two. What's our second choice for this song based on a literary character, Rosie?
It's going to have to be White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane, which of course references characters from Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. It's a great one.
Female voice there, Rosie.
Right.
It's Grace Slick. I had to look her up. I was like, I'm sure she's dead. She's still alive, 76 years old. I wonder what state her mind is in now, but I imagine some psychedelic drug use.
She's probably just sitting there reading Alice in Wonderland all the time.
Yep, just waiting for Judge Holden.
Because he will get you in the end, and it's going to scare you so badly. So I have another song for us, Steele.
Nice. I'm ready.
This is by the greatest citizen of one of the worst states of the union. This is Bruce Springsteen, the greatest thing to ever come out of New Jersey. And Bruce Springsteen, he loves the Grapes of Wrath. Big fan. Wrote a wonderful song, The Ghost of Tom Joad.
Walking along the railroad tracks, going someplace and there's no going back. Highway patrol choppers coming up over the ridge. Hot soup on a campfire in the bridge. Shelter line stretching around the corner. Welcome to the new world order. Sleeping in the car in the southwest. No home, no job, no peace, no rest. Well, the highway is alive tonight, but nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes. I'm sitting down here in the campfire line, searching for the ghost of time travel.
What a storyteller. That's a ballad.
I love when Bruce does that for me. Just the slow ballad about hard times. You know any Bruce Springsteen song that's a classic is going to cover hard times.
Yeah. Okay, so you guys did a nice job. I mean, you picked decent songs or whatever, but I want to close this out with the song to remember. Probably the finest work of art ever made about literature. I mean, maybe even the finest work of literature, full stop. This is the great Loggins and Messina track, House at Pooh Corner. And Dave, this one's dedicated to you and the triplets.
Branches lit up by the moon. posing our questions to Al and Dio as our days disappeared all too soon. But I've wandered much further today than I should, and I can't seem to find my way back to the wood. So help me if you can, I've got to get back to the house and the corner by one. You'd be surprised, there's so much to be done. Count all the bees in the hive, chase all the clouds from the sky. Back to the days of Christopher Robin.
Can we fade this out yet?
I wanted to just hear the first.
I have heard that before, and yeah, it's a golden classic.
There's so much to love about that song. Obviously, it's a reference to the great realist novels by A.A. Milne, featuring Winnie the Pooh and the lovable gang of Tigger and Eeyore. And the...
It just transports you to a magical place, the Hundred Acre Wood.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if I can find my way back out of the Hundred Acre Wood after hearing that song.
Well, luckily we're going to stay there, because Rosie has some Pooh-themed book wisdom.
Yeah, Pooh Bear-themed book wisdom.
Oh, okay.
Now that we know that Winnie inspires some real musical genius, we also need to let you know that he's also a practitioner of Taoism, some might say, even a great inspiration for those trying to live a Taoist lifestyle. Mm. So I'm going to share some book wisdom. Actually, just the brief foreword from The Tao of Pooh, which is by Benjamin Hoff. "What's this you're writing?" asked Pooh, climbing onto the writing table. "The Tao of Pooh," I replied. "The how of Pooh?" asked Pooh, smudging one of the words I had just written. "The Tao of Pooh," I replied, poking his paw away with my pencil. "It seems more like the Ao of Pooh," said Pooh, rubbing his paw. "Well, it's not," I replied huffily. "What's it about?" asked Pooh, leaning forward and smearing another word. "It's about how to stay happy and calm under all circumstances," I yelled. "Have you read it?" asked Pooh. That was after some of us were discussing the great masters of wisdom, and someone was saying how all of them came from the East, and I was saying that some of them didn't. But he was going on and on, just like this sentence, not paying any attention, when I decided to read a quotation of wisdom from the West to prove that there was more to the world than one half. And I read, "When you wake up in the morning..." "Pooh," said Piglet at last, "what's the first thing you say to yourself?" "What's for breakfast?" said Pooh. "What do you say, Piglet?" "I say, I wonder what's going to happen exciting today," said Piglet. Pooh nodded thoughtfully. "It's the same thing," he said. "What's that?" the unbeliever asked. "Wisdom from a Western Taoist," I said. "It sounds like something from Winnie the Pooh," he said. "It is," I said. "That's not about Taoism," he said. "Oh, yes, it is," I said. "What do you think it's about?" "It's about this dumpy little bear that wanders around asking silly questions, making up songs, and going through all kinds of adventures without ever accumulating any amount of intellectual knowledge or losing his simple-minded sort of happiness. That's what it's about," he said. "Same thing," I said. That's when I began to get an idea to write a book that explained the principles of Taoism through Winnie the Pooh and explained Winnie the Pooh through the principles of Taoism. When informed of my intentions, the scholars exclaimed "preposterous" and things like that. Others said it was the stupidest thing they'd ever heard and that I must be dreaming. Some said it was a nice idea, but too difficult. Just where would you even begin? Well, an old Taoist saying puts it this way: 1,000-mile journey starts with one step.
Well chosen. What a fitting end to an episode devoted to characters.
He is a wonderful character. I love the Pooh Bear.
Well, we're definitely going to use that in outtakes.
Rosie, thank you for coming on today. It was fun to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh man, I love the Pooh Bear. You know I like the sweatiness. Did Messina just die? Whatever happened to that guy?
I think he became a pitcher. Didn't he pitch for the Yankees?
Yeah, he was quite successful, actually. He had a great career. Never won the big one.
He won the big one by being in Loggins and Messina.